Well, thank you. And just to give you a quick rundown of what's happening in the next month, yes, next Saturday and Sunday I'll be speaking at Eagle Rock Assembly. And I had a meeting with the pastor, and he's come up with an interesting strategy to deal with a controversy that always surrounds reasons to believe. He says, I'm going to interview you. That way people can't say you're speaking on a subject that could be offensive to theistic evolutionists or young earth creationists or whatever. But he's going to interview me on four different topics. Saturday night, he's going to interview me about my testimony. And each one is a 40-minute long interview. So these are in-depth interviews. And then Sunday morning, the first service, it's going to be on how do you deal with the first 11 chapters of Genesis and how do you deal with skeptics' responses that these books really have no scientific accuracy. And then the main or later service on Sunday, one at 11:15, it's going to be about our testable creation model and how we use that as a way to engage people who have not been to church, people that are part of the scientific community. And then Sunday evening, it's going to be about why the universe is the way it is. And what's going to happen Sunday evening is that there will be the service, and right after the service, we're going to segue into an auditorium where anybody can ask me questions. The pastor will shut up, and everybody else gets to ask questions. But yeah, we are going to need people. They're giving us 8 book tables for all 4 events. So that's why we're kind of looking for volunteers, because we need enough people at those book tables. And this is a place where they have large numbers of people coming to faith in Christ, new visitors. It's typical that, they're actually growing at a rate of 15% every 6 months. And a lot of it through adult converts. So he says, please bring enough people that you can not only handle book sales and video sales, but also be available to talk to people. And that's something my wife really enjoys doing. She'll hang around the book table, look at somebody standing off at a distance with a quizzical look on their face, and she just goes up and starts talking to them. So if you can at all help, we would very much appreciate it.
Do you know if any of this is going to be available online afterwards?
They are going to record the whole thing, both video and audio. So that will be available both through...
So we can still volunteer for the book table.
Yes.
Yes. So, there are people who are planning to come just for the public Q&A after the fourth service. They can't make it for, I think it's like 6:30 or 7, I forget. I think it's 6:30 Sunday night. The times are on there. I probably got the times wrong. In fact, I got it right here. Yeah, 6 o'clock is the Sunday evening thing, but right afterwards there will be the public Q&A, and I know people are only going to be able to come to that. So I'm not saying you've got to come to all, but if you can come to one, that would be very much appreciated. And if you know someone else that can help out, let us know. So what's going to be happening the following Sunday? I'm going to be involved in a project in Alabama where they're going to be featuring a young earth creationist, a theistic evolutionist, and I'll be representing Reasons to Believe. Each of us will have a time to speak. And then there will be a separate time where people can ask questions. Then all 3 representatives are going to dialogue with one another. Then the audience gets to dialogue with all of us. It's going to be spread over 4 days. So they'll be recording that as well. And that's being sponsored by Fixed Point Ministries. They have it all up on their website. Following that, I'm going to be going to... it's headquarters of the Assemblies of God. In Missouri, and they've invited about 8 scientists across the theological spectrum to speak on Genesis and creation. And so I'll be kind of taking, they asked me to speak on Genesis 1, and the other plenary speakers, there's about 7 other plenary speakers, they all hold the position that Genesis can't be reconciled with science. So I'll be the one guy there saying, I think it can be done. And anyways...
Sounds like a new openness on their part.
Well, what's interesting about the Assemblies of God, and this is something I'm also seeing at Eagle Rock Assembly, is that the denomination has recognized that they've developed a reputation over the past 100 years of being anti-intellectual and anti-scientific. And my wife grew up with a lot of the leaders of the Assemblies of God. In fact, she knows the head honchos back there in Springfield. And about 10 years ago, about a dozen years ago now, they were communicating with us that they want to turn that reputation around. And so they're making a concerted effort at reaching out to the universities, to the scientists and engineers, and to really bring the Assemblies of God at the forefront of trying to engage people at the highest intellectual levels. And this conference is designed to facilitate that. But as I look at the other speakers, they're predominantly theistic evolutionists. So, and it's something I've seen over the past 20 years is a lot of people quote from Franz De Leeche, who made the comment. I don't remember if I can get the quote off the top of my head, but that it's hopeless and always will be hopeless to try to take the message of creation in Genesis and integrate it with the established scientific record. So, and you know, from my perspective, a lot of it has to do with taking the wrong frame of reference. If the Spirit of God is up there in the heavens looking down on the earth, yes, it's going to be teaching scientific nonsense. But Genesis 1-2, the Spirit of God is hovering over the surface of the waters. And it's dark on the surface of the waters, as it tells us in Job 38, because God blanketed the oceans with a cloud layer that wouldn't let any light pass through. And from that context, it's really quite straightforward to show that it's a perfect fit with the established scientific record. Anyway, that's what I'm going to be doing in Springfield. And so what's happening thereafter? Well, Kathy and I are actually going to take a vacation. Kind of a rare thing for us to do. We're going to do that. And actually, it's a dream of about 25 years, more than that, 30 years now, because it was about, it was 31 years ago. I took Kathy into a place called the Opavin Plateau in the mountains of British Columbia, and we walked all the way in. And then she noticed there was a lodge on the way we walked in. Says, why aren't we staying here? Says, you mean we hiked 10 miles just to get to this place and we got another 6 miles to go? And how come we're not staying? I said, well, it's almost impossible to get a reservation there. And she says, well, let's see what we can do. Well, they take reservations on a certain day in early January. And within about 50 minutes, they sell out the entire year. So I've been calling that day every January for the past 30 years. And this year, they had an opening. So now, of course, the ideal time to go there is August and September after the snow has at least partly melted. And there was no August-September dates. The only dates I could get were at the very beginning of July. So there'll still be lots of snow there, but I was trying to convince Kathy, snow is beautiful. So do I need to take snowshoes? I said, I don't think so. But by that time, the snow gets quite hard. So, but we're also going to take the opportunity to visit the Bugaboo Climbing Hut. And it's a place I went when I was 29 years of age. With a bunch of Caltech climbers, and a gorgeous place. They've now got a road into the place. You can now get there with just a 3-mile walk. So it's much easier to get to than when I did it many years ago. Although you still have to go up these rickety ladders to get up an escarpment. So, but I've assured Kathy that we'll take a little rope to take the packs up, and it's not that bad. I did it with a full pack when I was 29. So she said, well, we're older now. You've got to take that into account. But anyway, it's going to be, hopefully the weather will be decent. In both places, you can get blizzards in July. So, when you're in the Canadian mountains, you just never know. I mean, in fact, this place in the Bugaboos, they do skiing, but in the wintertime, they close it down because there's too much snow. They wait till it's a little safer to ski. So quite different from here in America. So, yes.
When you say an event is recorded, does that mean that you ultimately get it at Reason?
Yes.
Is that how we?
Yes. So we'll have it, and they'll have it, and it'll be both video and audio. Excuse me. Well, let me start off here with a rather amazing discovery that was published just this past week. And what it is a solution, finally, after 40 years, to what's called the faint sun paradox. And we've been getting closer and closer to the solution over the years, but I think now they've got it nailed down. And if you don't know what the faint sun paradox is, it was something that was coined by Carl Sagan back in 1972. He actually developed in 71, so it's literally been 40 years since the model was developed. And it was Carl Sagan and George Mullen, his student, recognizing that the sun gets brighter and brighter as it gets older and older. It gets brighter and brighter because it's converting hydrogen into helium in its nuclear furnace. If you want to know what the sun's like, it's like a gigantic hydrogen bomb. That's what a hydrogen bomb does. It fuses hydrogen into helium. And that's where you get the greatest energy release in nuclear physics, is hydrogen to helium. That's why a hydrogen bomb is so much more explosive than, say, a uranium bomb or a plutonium bomb. And so as it converts hydrogen to helium, helium is much denser than hydrogen. And so the density of the core goes up. And when the density of the core goes up, it causes the furnace to burn hotter and hotter as the sun gets brighter and brighter. And so it was Carl Sagan who published this curve. Maybe we could dim at least some of the lights here so you can see this. That if you go back to when life originated on planet Earth, about 3.8 billion years ago, right about here, you'd have the sun about 70% dimmer than it is today. But if it's 70% dimmer than it is today, how is it that light could survive 3.8 billion years ago? Because you make the sun 70% dimmer, the entire planet is frozen solid. There'd be no liquid water, no water vapor at all. All the water would be in a permanent frozen state. So that's what he called it, the faint sun paradox. You know, how do you get the surface of the Earth warm enough that it can sustain life that early? And what Carl Sagan and George Mullen proposed back in 1971 and 2 is that the early Earth had lots of ammonia. And ammonia is a powerful greenhouse gas, and so the early Earth's atmosphere had lots of ammonia. It would trap enough of the sun's heat that even though it was 30% dimmer, it would be still warm enough on the surface of the Earth that life could survive. However, it was only a few years before geophysicists were able to discern there was no way Earth had that much ammonia. In fact, Earth wouldn't have any ammonia at all. There was no way to produce that kind of ammonia, and if there was that ammonia, the sun's radiation would break down the ammonia and it would dissipate. And so, no ammonia, what are you going to do next? Well, James Casting, an Origin of Life researcher, in the 1980s, came up with a model where he said if we pump the Earth's atmosphere with lots of carbon dioxide, that'll trap enough heat that we can compensate for the 30% dimmer sun. However, by the early 1990s, there was a recognition that there's no way that much carbon dioxide could be in the atmosphere of the Earth. If there was that much carbon dioxide, we'd be seeing carbonate signatures in the crust of the Earth that we don't see, and the other carbon chemicals that are also missing in the crust of the Earth. That didn't stop James Casting. He said, well, maybe if we have methane, because methane is an even more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So he says the combination of carbon dioxide and methane compensates for the increase or decreased luminosity of the sun. However, the combination of that much methane and that much carbon dioxide also would leave chemical signatures in the crust of the Earth that we don't see. And therefore, that really threw the whole research. I mean, for 30 years, they're thinking, we got a solution, and now we realize carbon dioxide and methane and any combination won't be adequate to compensate for the dimmer sun. But then a piece of research was done at Caltech, actually by a lady who was a graduate student at the University of Toronto the same time I was, Juliana Sackman. In fact, she wound up marrying the provost of Caltech. And that provost was Robert Christie was his name. He was involved in the Manhattan Project. He was the one that worked out the mathematics to develop the trigger to make the uranium-235 bomb work. And that's one reason why they had to test the thing in New Mexico, because they weren't sure the mathematics was done exactly right, but it turns out it was, and it worked. So they were able to proceed to end World War II. But his real claim to fame is that he's an expert on the theory of star formation and stellar structure. In fact, I had to read a number of his textbooks when I was a graduate student, particularly expert at the physics of Cepheid variable stars. And he's also been responsible for developing the best model for the history of the sun. And that's something that Juliana Sackman took up from him, is to develop even better models for the history of solar burning. And she was the one that produced this particular resolution to the faint sun paradox. What she demonstrated is that if you look at the physics of the sun, particularly the helioseismology data, what really made this all possible is we had a couple of satellites that were measuring sun quakes. I mean, you've all heard of earthquakes. The sun has quakes as well. And so they've been measuring these quakes with satellites, particularly the SOHO satellite. And those quakes tell us a lot about the interior physics of the sun. And that allowed her to build a much more detailed model for the burning history of the sun. And in particular, supported the conclusion that when the sun was very young, it was accumulating mass and therefore getting brighter. And then it began to lose mass and therefore got dimmer. Now, the reason why this is a significant contribution to the faint sun paradox is that the brightness of a star is proportional to the 3.9 power of its mass, roughly the fourth power. And so, for example, if you were to increase the mass of the sun by 20%, that would double its brightness. So you just multiply 1.2, you get the idea, the fourth power. And so what she was able to discern is that this sunquake data indicated that the sun had dimmed by a minimum of 4% and maybe as much as 7% during its youth. Well, instead of having the sun being 30% dimmer at the time of life's origin, it's now about 85% dimmer at the time of life's origin, which means you don't need as much carbon dioxide and methane in the early Earth's atmosphere. And, you know, one thing that James Casting was saying when he realized that, you know, methane's rapidly destroyed by the sun, and that's true. The sun's radiation, the ultraviolet radiation in particular, would break down methane in the Earth's atmosphere. And by the way, that's one thing that's good about all the methane that cows emit. As they emit methane, the solar radiation breaks it down so it doesn't accumulate and become a problem for life here on Earth. But what James Casting was pointing out is if you get a steady flux of methane into the atmosphere from life, not cows, because cows didn't exist that early, but bacteria did. And there's bacteria that we call methanogens. Methanogens are bacteria that eat various chemicals and throw out methane as a waste product. So he says if we pack the Earth with enough methanogens, then even though the sun's radiation is destroying that methane, if you pump enough of it in, you can maintain a balance that will resolve the faint sun paradox. So being aware of the model by Juliana Sackman, that's kind of what he came up with, is let's just have the lots of methanogens in the early Earth. Now, you really do need a lot of methanogens, even to compensate for just a 15% dimming of the sun. And it raises a big problem for the origin of life, because at the origin of life, you don't have methanogens. And so how is the first life going to be able to survive when the sun is 15% dimmer? Because there you don't have a biological source of methane. It takes time for the biology to begin producing adequate methane. Yes.
I guess you're assuming that there's another source of heat that's not enough to make a difference, and that is as the Earth is collapsing and compacting, it gets hot. So we know that it's very hot down in the middle of the Earth's core, and that heat, of course, gradually comes out to the surface. You must be assuming that's negligible.
It is negligible and was negligible at the time of life's origin. It's not negligible if you get right here. So right here, it's a significant heat source.
Okay.
By the time you get to 3.8 billion years ago, it's a trivial heat source. Likewise, you do get some heat just from uranium and thorium that's embedded in the crust of the Earth.
Yeah.
But it's trivial compared to all these other factors. And so that's why Casting's team has been appealing to methanogens. It's the one place you can go. So we can't get the carbon dioxide up high enough, but maybe the combination of carbon dioxide and methane will do it. But it doesn't resolve the problem of why the planet was warm enough for the very first life forms on planet Earth. So even with the model with Juliana Sackman, we have an issue here. Now, what is brand new is that they're now beginning to do starquake studies on other stars, not just our sun. And also, we're now beginning to have much more detailed observations of the ultraviolet radiation and X-ray radiation coming out of what we call young solar analogs. A young solar analog is a star that's the same mass as our sun, as it would have been at the time of the sun's early youth, and has a young age. So what they're doing is looking at stars with a known age, and where the age is in this neighborhood right here, but it's the same characteristics as our star, the sun. Now, you've heard me say before that there is no star that's a true twin of the sun. And that is still true. I mean, there's certain features, particularly the lithium abundance, that's not matched in these solar analogs. And that's why they call them solar analogs, not solar twins. They're close to the characteristics of the sun, but they're not right on, because we can't find any stars that are right on. But they're all young stars, and this new research study published in the Astrophysical Journal is making the point that although they're not true solar twins, they kind of bracket the spectrum of characteristics around stars that are close to the characteristics of the sun. And all of them reveal substantially more mass loss than 4 to 7%. None of them are coming in as low as 4 to 7%. They're coming in the range of 20 to 30%. Now, in the research study, the astronomers felt that maybe you won't get the sun coming in as high as 30%, but it's certainly reasonable it could come in as high as 20%. And what that does is it gives us a new model for the change in the luminosity of the sun. And this is what it would look like. This is assuming that the sun at its peak mass was 20% more massive than it is today, which would be way up there somewhere, which would put the brightness of the sun at about twice what it is right now. But then it would drop very quickly down to about 89 to 90%. Roughly the 90% level would be the minimum brightness, and then it would gradually brighten there after. Well, now that we have the sun no dimmer than 90% of its current brightness, it resolves all the problems. No longer do we have a problem of trying to say, where are we going to get the greenhouse gases? No longer do we have a problem making the planet warm enough at the time of life's origin. It's challenging at the time of life's origin. The planet is quite cool, but it's not such that it's impossible. And once you get methanogens being produced, you can warm the planet up in fairly short order. But what it does do is it shows us that just before the origin of life on planet Earth, you've got major changes taking place in the sun's luminosity. Moreover, with the sun's luminosity dropping that rapidly, that would also imply that you've got a sun that's extremely unstable during that stage. What I mean by that is a very aggressive flaring activity, a lot of variability in its brightness, And a lot of intense ultraviolet, particularly the short ultraviolet and X-ray radiation coming out of the sun. We're actually seeing that in all these solar analogs. Every young solar analog is throwing out way more ultraviolet and X-ray radiation and luminosity variability than we thought was possible even a few years ago. Now, so far, they've only looked at about 20 solar analogs, but there's lots of them out there, literally hundreds. And so this can be done with a lot more definition and accuracy than what has been published just a few days ago. But what this does is that it really eliminates the possibility that you've got micro origins of life taking place before 3.8 billion years ago. I mean, I've shown you this graph before, which shows the bombardment history of the Earth with respect to time. Bombardment by asteroids, comets, planetesimals, and how it exponentially declines until about 4 billion years ago. And then you get this spike here called the late heavy bombardment, and right here, 3.8 billion years ago, you got the origin of life. And there's been some speculation that maybe this curve drops down quite deep like here, and then in here you might have brief episodes where you could have liquid water and rocks, and indeed zircons that we've been studying that date in this region do tell us that there were very brief episodes where the planet was warm enough that you could have liquid water and you could have solid rocks. And therefore there's been speculation that maybe there were origin of life episodes in here. And by the way, that was the reason that Fuzz and I titled our book Origins of Life Plural rather than The Origin of Life Singular, because we felt that there may be a reason why the Creator would want to create life earlier, before the late heavy bombardment, even though he knew that that life would be quickly wiped out, if for one no other reason to begin to kind of jumpstart the pumping of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. That's still a possibility, but what this model is telling us right here is that it's a possibility, but it's quite unlikely, because look at what's happening to the sun. Even if you've got a brief episode where you've got liquid water on the surface of the Earth and you've got rocks that are solid rather than molten, you've got the sun pumping out such deadly radiation at such great intensity, with the sun's luminosity varying at such an extreme level that it's not very favorable for life on Earth. And it also supports what you see in Genesis 1-2. What does it tell us about the conditions of the Earth before the origin of life? It was tohu lo bohu, formless and void. Which means it was unfit for life and empty of life, and this would certainly fit the description that it was not pleasant for life at that time, quite unfit. So maybe we need to title the second edition of our book The Origin of Life Singular rather than The Origins of Life Plural. So that's kind of where things stand right now. But yeah, it does mean that we are looking at a single sudden origin of life event after the late heavy bombardment. Yes?
The extra amount of debris and cloud cover in those first billion years, would that significantly cut down on that spike in terms of what's hitting the surface of the Earth?
You definitely do have a heavier atmosphere before the late heavy bombardment. It's not that much less dense than we have now. What really stripped the Earth's atmosphere was the moon-forming event. That got rid of 99% of Earth's atmosphere. Now, the late heavy bombardment got rid of a lot more, but nothing to be compared with the moon-forming event. So, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if Earth's atmosphere was thinned by, say, 50% at the late heavy bombardment, but nothing like what happened earlier.
So the light hitting the surface of the Earth, as it says in Genesis 1, 2, I believe, 2 to 3, would you think that's maybe the moon-forming event that allowed the light to penetrate?
Well, let there be light is Genesis 1, 3, and I believe that's a reference to right after the late heavy bombardment. So right through all here, you're looking at an opaque atmosphere. So yes, it wouldn't have been as dense as it was at the time of the moon forming event. The moon forming event would be about somewhere here, a late heavy bombardment here. But there's also some new understanding in the late heavy bombardment that also tells us that conditions here are quite hostile to life, not just because of what's happening in the sun, but what's also happening in the solar system. And I got an article on this on our Today's New Reasons to Believe that you can look at. It's actually four articles talking about all the amazing events that are taking place in the solar system during this era that paved the way for the origin of life. But one is a new understanding of what caused the late heavy bombardment. I've talked a little bit about it before. It's a 1-2 resonance between Jupiter and Saturn. What we now have is an understanding of what generated the 1-2 resonance between Jupiter and Saturn. Just let me define my terms here. A 1-2 orbital resonance is a situation where Jupiter makes exactly two orbits of the Sun for every single orbit of Saturn. Now, for that to work, Jupiter and Saturn have to be a very specified distance from each other and from the Sun. Now, we've known for some time that that resonance event is what generated the late heavy bombardment. When you got that 1-2 resonance, it basically destabilizes what's now called the Kuiper Belt. The Kuiper Belt today is only 1% the size it was before the late heavy bombardment. But that Jupiter-Saturn alignment basically destabilizes huge belt of comets and asteroids and caused our Earth to be bombarded by at least 20,000 big colliders within a relatively narrow window of time. And that's transformed the surface of the Earth into molten lava, literally hundreds of kilometers deep. But then it subsided, and we have the origin of life. We know this late heavy bombardment occurred at that time because of the cratering we see on the Moon and Mars and Jupiter. Those three bodies have different erosion rates, and as we measure the erosion of the craters on the Moon, Mercury, and Mars, they all testify that between 90 and 98% of all the cratering events happened 3.87 billion years ago. That's when it peaked. 3.87 billion years ago. But it's been a mystery for some time what caused it. It's the 1-2 resonance. But then it was another mystery, what caused the 1-2 resonance? Well, in the last few months, a group of astronomers, predominantly headquartered in Nice, France, and so they call this the Nice model for the solar system. So that's just where these astronomers happen to do their research. And the Nice model says that there's a jumping Jupiter phenomena. A jumping Jupiter phenomena is where either one of Uranus or Neptune winds up having a close encounter with Saturn, and as a result of that close encounter, gets thrown inward to the solar system, heading towards the Sun. And as it goes inward towards the Sun, it winds up having a close encounter with Jupiter, and that close encounter with Jupiter causes that body to be ejected rapidly outward in the solar system. So it speeds at a rapid velocity. Most people think it was Neptune that got scattered by Saturn and Jupiter. But the phenomenon is called the jumping Jupiter model. And once Jupiter has that close encounter, say with Neptune, and throws Neptune way out, it causes a separation of the orbits of Jupiter and Saturn. So Jupiter and Saturn were much closer together before the late heavy bombardment, but this jumping Jupiter phenomena caused the orbits to separate. And this is what generated the 1-2 resonance, which caused this heavy bombardment. And by the way, if it wasn't for that heavy bombardment, we would not have a strong, stable magnetic field. And we wouldn't have strong, stable plate tectonics. Because that late heavy bombardment injected the core of the Earth with sulfur and oxygen. And it's that extra sulfur and oxygen that set up a strong, stable magnetic field, set up a situation where you've got a solid inner core surrounded by a liquid core. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the late heavy bombardment that made it possible for you to enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner, because that magnetic field prevents our atmosphere from being sputtered away by solar radiation, and also prevents radiation from cosmic rays in the sun going through and they're killing us. And the magnetic field likewise blocks out a lot of deadly radiation and allows us to see the beautiful aurora borealis. If you happen to live at a sufficiently high latitude, you can see that. So now we seem to be tying all the loose strings together in terms of the origin of life. We know what caused the late heavy bombardment. We know what's going on with the sun. And we actually are now coming to a consensus that we're looking at a single origin of life. A single origin of life has now been established to date back 3.83 billion years ago. Well, with a firming up of the evidence that the peak of this late heavy bombardment looks like it's coming in at about 3.87, although some will argue it could be as early as 3.9, but nevertheless, that only leaves you about 40 million years to go from a very hot global lava heat type condition down to where you've got water and rocks. And as several Origin of Life researchers have commented, you'll see their quotes in our book on the origins of life, the very moment that Earth has liquid water and rocks, you've got the origin of life. There's no time between the cooling of the Earth from the late heavy bombardment where you got the first possible conditions for life to survive and we actually have life on the Earth, and not just any kind of life. We see life in abundance and we see life in diversity. It's not the last universal common ancestor. It's a whole ecology of single-celled bacterial species, some of which are engaging in photosynthesis. Some of them are methanogens. And you've got a whole suite of other chemoautotrophs that are operating simultaneously at that time. And it looks like even the sulfate-reducing bacteria are showing up at that very early moment. All that would be what you'd expect from a creator that's aggressively preparing the planet as quickly as possible for human life. Now, when I speak to biologists about this, they kind of are disturbed by that language. You know, 3.83 billion years, that's aggressive. That's a God that's in a hurry to get everything just right. That seems like a lot of time. But when you actually consider what we human beings need to launch and sustain global high technology civilization, where there's billions of us taking advantage of that high technology civilization, it's utterly amazing that the Creator can do it as fast as it's just 3.83 billion years. So that's why sometimes I refer to myself as a young Earth creationist, because I believe that God actually did it very quickly in just 3.83 billion years. It seems unfathomable that it could happen that fast, but that's one of the signatures that indeed it was a mind that was super intelligent and supernatural, because look how quickly he made it all happen. Yes?
Do we understand why Venus still retains such a very dense atmosphere, being closer to the sun? What prevents that from being sputtered?
Well, Venus also lost a lot of its atmosphere because of the late heavy bombardment, but it didn't have a moon-forming event. 99% of our water in our atmosphere was eliminated through the moon-forming event. That didn't happen to Venus. So Venus today has an atmosphere that's 40 times thicker than the Earth, even though it's closer to the sun and even though it's less massive. Now, if it wasn't for the moon-forming event, our atmosphere today would be 100 times as dense as it is. Now, 100 times denser means that you'd have the surface of our planet blistering hot, far too hot for life. After all, if you go to Venus, the surface temperature is hot enough to melt lead all the time, permanently that hot. And also, the atmosphere would be so thick that it'd be impossible to have lungs or gills. I mean, our lungs won't work if the air pressure gets about 2 or 3 times denser than what it is. In fact, I don't know how many have ever been to the bottom of the Dead Sea. I've been there. And what you notice, it's 1,300 feet below sea level. And the atmosphere is quite a bit thicker there. And you can actually notice that it's a little harder to breathe at the bottom of the Dead Sea than it is at sea level. So, you know, our lungs are needing a very... In fact, it also works the other way. If you drop the air pressure by about a factor of three, you will die. You increase it by a factor of three, you'll also die. And you really want to be within a factor of two. And so, you know, when you go up Mount Everest, you go into what's called the death zone. And that's where the atmosphere gets about 2.5 times less dense than it is now. And there's nothing you can do to prevent your body from slowly dying when you're taking in that little oxygen at that altitude, which is why when people climb at that altitude, they spend as little time as possible above what they call the death zone. You spend more than a couple of days there, and you're not going to make it. So, and even if you go up Mount Whitney, you're going to notice that the atmosphere is a lot less dense. In fact, when I did the video shoots for Journey Toward Creation on top of Mauna Kea, I had all my cameramen passing out. And that was a shock because, you know, they were basically young men in their early 20s. But the thing about men is our lungs don't fully develop until we're 24. And so all of us old guys were doing fine. It was all the young ones that were passing out in front of us. So,
what's the longest hike you've been on? 60 miles?
Oh, I've been, yeah, that's on the flat. In terms of a mountain hike, the longest one I ever did was 47 miles. But that was with a long Canadian summer day. So it's really not that hard to do. No, we go 4 miles an hour for 12 hours, and that, you can do it. So. Stop for lunch. I mean,
on a mountain you're doing 4 miles an hour? Going up?
That was in Yoho National Park. That was younger. And I did it during late July, where you can literally almost hike all day. I mean, I started at 6 a.m. and kept going until, oh, probably about 7 or 8 p.m. So,
excuse me.
So, yeah, that really shocked Kathy the first time I took her into the Canadian mountains, because we hiked all day. I cooked her dinner, and she thought, well, now we're going to get ready to bed down. I says, oh, no, we've got 4 more hours of daylight left. Let's go for another hike. So I went for an after-dinner hike that went on until about 11 o'clock. Yes.
Did you say that you hiked 47 miles in one day?
Uphill. Yes.
One day.
Uphill both ways.
47 miles in one day.
It's not that hard to do.
I think I've just seen the face of God. That's it. Wow.
That's with a day pack. I didn't have a backpack on, just a day pack.
And how old were you?
Oh, I was like 28 at the time. So, I mean, yeah, when you're young and fit, so no problem.
Well, I was 16 and I did a charity walk, I think 32 miles. And at the end of that, I was practically crying. I was just...
Yeah, you probably did it here in Southern California, though.
No, I did it in Toronto.
In Toronto. Oh, well. It was summer, though. I've been in those Toronto summers.
It was in May. It was
in May. Yeah. Well, I mean, if it's cool, I mean, yeah, if it's hot and humid, you're not going to be able to do 47 miles. But it was relatively cool.
Yeah.
And just kept going. That includes photography. I took about 500 photos that day, too. So, anyway, we're off the subject. Yes.
I have a question. Because first, in the beginning, in Genesis, it was Earth was in darkness.
Right.
And in end times, in Revelation, it says we are still going back to darkness. And by scientifically, how you see that, Charles? Do we change our Earth, change orbit, and the planets come in one line in the clothing there?
Well, it's quite similar to this faint sun paradox. Let me bring this back again. It's one thing for the sun's luminosity to change, but if things happen in the atmosphere of the Earth, it can compensate for that. But of course, it can go the other way. What I believe Revelation 6, 8, and 16 are talking about is that the sun, moon, and stars' light will be dimmed. Now, a lot of people thought that God's going to actually alter the brightness of the sun, moon, and stars. But notice it mentions all three. It would be rather weird for all of them to be dimmed by one third exactly. I mean, they're all physically different. Doesn't it make more sense that the correct interpretation is something's happening in our atmosphere? And if something happens in our atmosphere, it will dim the light of all the heavenly bodies by the same amount. So I believe that's the correct interpretation of the text. It's not that the sun's going to get dimmer, but rather the light that we see from the sun coming to the surface of the earth would get dimmer. Now, Isaiah 24 makes the prediction that at the time of the end, before the return of Jesus Christ to planet Earth, that humanity would begin to pollute its environment, literally begin to pollute ourselves to death. So, I mean, if we pump a lot of pollutants into the atmosphere, that will dim the light. Well, for example, those of us who live in the Los Angeles basin, the average dimming of the light of the sun, moon, and stars right now is 11%. So the human eye doesn't notice 11% very easily, but it is dimmed, which is why it's harder to get a suntan in Los Angeles than it is, say, in one of those tropical islands that people go to. They get shocked at the bad sunburn they get. So now, if you're in Shanghai, the light already is being dimmed by one-third, because there the pollution is much more intense.
You think it's about pollution, not about changing our orbit, Earth?
I think it's pollution, because that's consistent with what I see in the other prophetic accounts about the time of the end. You know, in other words, it's humanity suffering the consequences of their abuse of the planet. And you see that in Genesis 1. God tells Adam and Eve, I'm putting you in charge. You're to manage the planet and all of its resources for the benefit of all life. And I got a book coming out this fall on Job, and there's three chapters in Job that give us detailed instructions on how we're to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. I think that's helpful, because a lot of skeptics say, here's God giving us a one-sentence command, but he never tells us how to fulfill it. Well, given that the book of Job's content predates that of Genesis, there's no need for Moses to flesh out the details of how we're to do that. Job already took care of that. But the fact that we see that emphasized both in Genesis and in the creation accounts in Job tells us that God is serious about humanity taking good care of the planet. And what we see predicted in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel is that at the time of the end, people will become so rebellious against the authority of God that they will, in their greed, pollute their own environment, even unto their death. And what Revelation is speaking about is how there's going to be a gradual thing. But you notice about Revelation 6, 8, and 16. 6, it's a one-quarter impact. Revelation 8, it's one-third. And then it becomes a global impact. And that, too, kind of fits a pollution scenario, that it gets worse and worse as time goes on, rather than getting better and better. And so Revelation 6, it's at the one-quarter level. Revelation 8, the one-third level. And so, and also talks about how the light of the sun, moon, and stars will turn red like the blood of a corpse. That, too, is consistent with pollution. Or maybe widespread forests and grass fires, because that's one of the tribulation predictions or catastrophes that's predicted, that a third of the forests and grasslands on the planet would be burnt. And if that were to take place, it would throw so much dust into the atmosphere, it would turn the light of the sun, moon, and stars red like the blood of a corpse. Any of you who've lived here in the L.A. Basin for more than a couple of years have already seen that effect. If there's a big forest fire going on near where you live, when you look up at the moon and the sun, they become deep red in their color because of all the smoke particles in the atmosphere. So I think there's a way to consistently interpret that without doing anything weird with the physics of the sun. Because right now the sun is in a very stable luminosity phase. In fact, neutrino studies tell us that it's in the most stable luminosity phase it's ever been throughout its 4.7 billion year history. And so I really don't think we can use the sun as a way to interpret those texts. Okay, what we really wanted to do, however, is actually get into the origin of humanity. And by the way, this is now front page news in the Christian community. This will be published shortly. Christianity Today, we got an advance notice of what they intend to publish, but it's going to go on their cover, and it's titled The Search for the Historical Adam, and basically describes a controversy that's running throughout the entire Christian community about the origin of humanity. And a lot of it is coming from genomics research, where people studying the human genome have been persuaded that we're not descended from one couple, Adam and Eve, a few tens of thousands of years ago, but that we're descended from a large population. And moreover, they're comparing our genome to the genome of the chimpanzee and saying that we have a recent common ancestor and we got here through common descent rather than through some supernatural creative events by God. We do get mention in here. They do mention the debate that's been going on between Dr. Venema and Dr. Rana. Dr. Venema is the chairman of the biology department at Trinity Western University in Canada, that now ranks as the largest Christian campus on the entire continent. So the biggest Christian university is not in the U.S., it's in Canada. They don't have many in Canada, so. And it's located in a place that's about 80% Christian, so I think that's why it's got such an enormous population of people. And I spoke there many years ago, and then the big issue was young earth creationism. And so they were worried that I wasn't taking the Bible seriously, but they let me give some lectures on why I believe the Bible teaches an old earth perspective, not a young earth perspective. And there was a lot of interest in partnering with Reasons to Believe. But thanks to their biologists and their theologians, the whole campus has gone into a theistic evolution direction. And they're kind of partnering with BioLogos. And anyway, it's all described here in Christianity Today. But it also describes a reaction from a number of conservative theologians and particular people like Jack Collins and Walter, trying to think of his last name.
Kaiser.
Walter Kaiser. And both of those individuals have been making the point, look, if you let go of the doctrine that we're all descended from Adam and Eve, through whom we inherited our sin nature and through whom we have our image of God, this really does undercut a foundational doctrine of the church that the church has always held. And it's really difficult to defend any kind of viable salvation doctrine if we let go of those things. So it's an interesting set of debates that are going on here. But one thing I do appreciate is they credited Fuzz with making a comment, just because we see similarities in the DNA doesn't mean that that proves common descent. It could prove common design. And there may be reasons why the Creator chooses common DNA templates, because what's optimal for one species will be optimal for other species. And what Fuzz has been arguing, by the way, the debate is up on our website. You can see Venema's articles and you can see Fuzz's articles. I think they've had at least four, if not five, back and forth rounds debating this: how do you interpret the similarity of DNA with Neanderthals, humans, and chimpanzees? And if you want, Fuzz has just posted an article making the point that this... I talked here about a year ago about how one research group thought they might be seeing a signal of some interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans, but the signal was only three times above the noise, and there was a lot of discussion that it might be a contamination thing because they're claiming that there was greater similarity between Europeans and Asians with Neanderthal DNA than there was with black Africans. But of the 11 researchers, none of them were black Africans. They're all Asians and Europeans. So that's an unsettled debate. And actually, we have several articles and podcasts that you can listen to about how that can be interpreted in the context of our model, if the result is real and if it's not real. But Fuzz has just posted a podcast and an article making a point that is now extremely unlikely that the interbreeding signal is real, because they've now readjusted the date for the latest of the Neanderthals. So the 30,000-year date that's been in the textbooks for the past 10 years has now been pushed back to 48,000 years, and it may be pushed back even earlier than that. So how did all this happen? Well, the only dating tools we had for those most recent Neanderthals were based on optical or thermal luminescence, which are notoriously inaccurate methods. You say, why don't we just use carbon-14? Well, carbon 14 is not always available. You have to have some carbon you can recover. And by the way, looking at 48,000 years, you're really outside the range of where carbon 14 can give you reliable results. Carbon 14 gives you good answers if you're within a factor of 6 of its half-life. Its half-life is 5,715 years. So once you get a factor of 6 older than that, then the tool isn't that useful anymore. But anyway, you can read Fuzz's article as to why the scientific community is now convinced that Neanderthals and humans had no contact with one another, because the Neanderthals died out so long ago in the past. Now, humans were living, we believe, before 48,000 years, but in a region considerably south of where Neanderthals' habitat reside. Yes?
So, in this Christianity Today thing, are you saying, because of the Trinity School and all that, that they are going with the theistic evolution model says that they're going to believe that they're from a chimpanzee? And they're going to teach that, basically?
Well, their basic premise is that the scientific evidence from based on genomics is so compelling, we have to reinterpret our Bible. And they kind of use the example of Galileo. There was a big controversy at the time of Galileo. Psalm 102 and Psalm 104, is this really saying that the earth is immovable, or is it movable from the perspective of the human author that's sitting on the earth? That was Galileo's whole point. The frame of reference makes a huge difference as to how you interpret the text. But it's Jack Collins and Walter Kaiser that are making the point this isn't that simple. It's not just, you know, looking at the text and saying, well, you know, we need to adjust the frame of reference. Their whole point is that when you look at Romans 5, for example, it's so explicit and detailed about Adam being the father of us all, through whom we got our image of God, and through whom we have our sin nature. He's referred to as the first Adam. Jesus is referred to as the second Adam. So how can you really sustain the theology of Romans? And it's the first 8 chapters of Romans that really gives you the most detailed laying out of the plan of salvation. So their whole point is, it's not just science that it's at stake. Literally, the whole Christian faith is at stake here. And Fuzz's point is, the scientific evidence is compelling, but the interpretation of that scientific evidence is not compelling. And moreover, the scientific case isn't finished yet. We need to continue studying these genomes to see if this supposed inherited junk DNA really serves no purpose. We're arguing that the purpose is there. And the track record, I think, is quite clear. What we've been calling junk DNA is getting smaller and smaller as we learn more and more. It's simply that the designs have been hidden from view. More research is exploring more of those designs. And you know, we're in constant dialogue with these folks, by the way. And it's a good dialogue. There's no hostility. And you know, what we're trying to do, and not only dialogue in the genomics, but saying you need a model that covers all the scientific disciplines. And so having a model that only looks at one scientific discipline can ignore the problems with a theistic evolutionary perspective in comparative disciplines. So we haven't really gotten anywhere, for example, talking about mass extinction events or mass speciation events, or the problem with transitional forms or the origin of life. That's one reason that we're trying to look at this. The origin of life, we argue, is the simplest problem for an evolutionist who's trying to explain the history of life with God simply working behind the scenes rather than directly to solve. Because all you're dealing with is relatively straightforward physics and chemistry. We'll let physics and chemistry, apart from God's supernatural intervention, explain the origin of life. And it's like, you know, from here on in, it gets much more complex. And if you haven't got a solution for the simplest problem, then why do you think everything's going to fit so beautifully from there on? And by the way, that's not just something where we're finding an issue with theistic evolutionists. Naturalistic evolutionists, likewise, are committed to duck the origin of life, as they are committed to duck the problem of where do you get the soulish animals if you have no soulish stuff there beforehand, and where do you get the spirit nature of humanity. Genesis 1, as I shared with you before, 3 origins of life. Origin of physical life, soulish life, and spiritual life. And we would argue that that's really the best way to engage evolutionists is have them deal with the origin issues. How do you explain these three separate origins? How do you explain it without God getting directly involved? So, but by the way, there is a wide spectrum across the theistic evolution frame. And what I find encouraging, it's the scientists that are much closer to our position than the theologians. It's the theologians that are convinced that science is forcing them to reinterpret the Bible. As I deal with the scientists, for example, of Biologos, they freely admit Romans 5 is a big problem. And, we can't let go of that. There needs to be some way that we can keep the data in the Bible consistent with the data in science. And they're quite free in admitting, this conclusion that we're descended from 10,000 plus people is model dependent. You actually have to presume an evolutionary model to get that high of a number. It doesn't necessarily follow that proves that the sample is that big. And moreover, the sample is getting progressively smaller. It used to be 10 million. Now it's down to 10,000 or less. Buzz would argue it's less than 1,000, and it's getting smaller as time goes on. The trend line is heading towards what the Bible teaches. And that's something you see in the scientific literature, is the fact that people are recognizing the trend line is going in that direction.
So when this comes out and there's all these churches, so we've got to kind of fight the, not only the younger, but these guys, because that is going to make a lot of people,
Well, what I think is good about this article, it's alerting the Christian community that, this is something that they need to pay attention to. Because, most people aren't even aware this debate is going on. And as Walter Kaiser points out, moreover, they're not aware of the consequences. This has huge ramifications, not only for scientific research, but for the status of biblical theology. And he says, for that reason, the church needs to take this issue very seriously. So in that case, I commend Christianity Today for making it a front page issue. Yes?
How does that jive with the findings that we can go back to a mitochondria Eve and a Y chromosome Adam?
Well, that is something we're seeing, is that if you look over the past, and you'll see this in our book, Who is Adam? That 20 years ago, there was an enormous population from many different regions descended from different species of bipedal primates that gave rise to human beings. That model is now gone. And we're now recognizing that we can't find a link with another bipedal primate species. They all seem to be dead ends. And we're looking at a single region and a single population, and that single population is small, which is why you see in the scientific literature this new human origins model being called the Garden of Eden hypothesis, because it is closely matching what the Bible teaches, and they're using biblical terminology. They refer to the first man as Adam and the first woman as Eve. Mitochondrial Eve, mitochondrial Adam. I'm sure you've seen this in a number of documentaries. Now, what Fuzz and I are arguing is that there's a reason why we see so much similarity in the DNA. And by the way, we don't concede for a minute that the similarity is anywhere as high as what Venema claims. We believe is at a much lower level, because what he's looking at is a small portion of the human genome and comparing it with a small portion of the chimpanzee genome. And if you're comparing places where they're coding for proteins, we would argue you would expect a very high degree of similarity, because those are the proteins that are coding for the the structure and the function of our internal organs. And except for the brain, the internal organs that we have are very similar to the internal organs of the great apes. And that's a good thing, because we're actually able to use these great apes for medical purposes. I mean, you can actually take these organs out of the great apes and put them in a human being, and they function. That wouldn't be possible unless the DNA was virtually identical for those. But as Fuzz has been pointing out, when you look at the DNA that governs brain structure for the human, and that for the Neanderthals and the great apes, you see a radical difference. That's where you see a big difference. And moreover, you see a big difference in terms of the DNA that governs our development. You know, Neanderthals and the great apes take only a few years to go from babyhood to adulthood. You heard me say a human male is 24 years. Some of you ladies might argue it's even longer than 24 years. But it is a long time, which means we need a much larger chunk of our DNA that governs our development. And it's important that certain genes be turned on at the right time and turned off at the right time. And because our development is so complex, that's where we see a lot of the distinctive. But getting back to the medical issue, there's a value in having our DNA similar to other species. So, for example, we notice that with mice and rats, you've got a DNA similarity with human beings in terms of the chemical pathways for memory, which means we're now using mice and rats for medical advances to deal with dementia and dyslexia and Alzheimer's disease. We're not using the apes, we're using mice and rats. And if you're arguing that God is taking a hands-off position and it's all descent with modification, then we would have to be descended from something like the mice and the rats. And again, some of you ladies might want to argue that. It would be true for certain men that you know. From an evolutionary perspective, you would anticipate that that DNA similarity could be most closely aligned with the chimpanzees and the gorillas, when in fact it comes in with the mice and the rats. And we're arguing that we need to actually do a lot more studies there. I mean, people really haven't looked at the armadillo very quickly, but I'll be willing to bet that the DNA similarity there is remarkably similar to human DNA as it pertains to leprosy. And we need to look elsewhere in the medical paradigm. Matter of fact, that might be a good way to develop medical advance. Start searching for DNA similarities of other species and see if that can be exploited to help our health industry do more than what it's been able to do. And it's amazing what our health industry has been able to do. I'm over time, aren't I? Okay, sorry about that. But that's kind of an introduction to what we're going to be talking about with human origins. And, you know, I kind of look at this whole issue. Human origins is the most complex of all the creation evolution issues we could possibly discuss. And why are we using the most complex and least understood science to be a basis for interpreting all the other sciences and as a basis for reinterpreting the 66 books of the Bible? There you got the rule. Always use the simple and the complete to interpret the complex and the incomplete. But we'll get into this a little further. And yes, there's lots of unanswered questions. I think that's what makes this issue so exciting. And actually, I think we've got a lot more medical advances we can develop through this study of genomics. It's not just going to help us resolve creation evolution issues. I think it's going to help us do more in terms of medical advance. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've had together. Thank you, Lord, for this exciting research about the history of the Son. And the Father, I pray that you give us the capacity to be able to integrate what's happening in astronomy and physics, biology, geophysics, chemistry, so that we can see more clearly your miraculous hand and what you have done to prepare this amazing planet and solar system for us. But, Lord, also to appreciate exactly why we're here, get some idea of the timing when you're going to bring everything to a close. And Lord, we look forward to that day when we can leave this universe and enter into the new creation where sin and evil, pain and suffering will never exist again. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.